top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 351 of the Really Awful Movies podcast, The Boy Behind the Door. Not to be confused with the 2016 horror film, The Boy. This one I came to on streaming services after reading a bunch of exemplary reviews and figuring why not, and was hoping it would hold up to my critical scrutiny. I came to this actually via a POV found footage flick that initially seemed enticing called The House October Built, which is a pretty bad title. It almost reminds me of like the house that Ruth built, referring to New York's Yankee Stadium, and obviously Babe Ruth helping to build that franchise. So it's like The House That October Built. It seemed off-putting title, to say the least, but I really, really warmed to I thought a really strong effort called Haunt, which is a 2015 Halloween haunted house movie that really stands out apart from some of the others in the space like Funhouse and whatnot, is a really taut and unflinching and really well done low budget horror in the spirit of I think the 80s, but really updated for modern times. So I thought, okay, House October Built, poor title, piss poor title accepted. I'm going to launch into that one. And then I was immediately dissuaded by all the jitteriness and the gravel acquiring dizziness inducing swaying of all the cameras. And I knew from the get go that even though they had really done a good job recreating newscasts to further the plot, I realized the entire shebang, the whole shebang would be using this POV sensibility that I really could not stomach 90 minutes of. I'm dangling my participles there, but I just thought, okay, this is not something I'm going to be really into. The Boy Behind the Door comes with critical accolades up the yin-yang, and it's one of these things that's a production by Shudder, and you got to marvel at just how production and distribution channels that overlap with the likes of Amazon Prime and Netflix and now Shudder have just completely upended the movie-going experience. I mean, the Jordan Peele written updating of the Candyman movie for 2021 just launched and in a bunch of theaters across Toronto and across North America and who knows, perhaps the world over. And my desire to go out and see a movie has been considerably curtailed by the Delta variants and just the inconvenience of it all. And I was thinking that it's pretty brilliant for the likes of Shudder and other streaming services to be in-house production teams too, because they are going to really be able to stick it to conventional studios, not to mention distributors and movie houses and the likes of your Cineplex up here and your Famous Players and all these other chains wherever that happen to exist, wherever you are in the world. And you know, to the extent this was available to me, I mean, sure, I would have preferred to see Candyman, but I don't want to put myself at that kind of risk and go out and source a babysitter and go through all this, especially since a critic I know and really, really, really trust, actually, Chris Alexander from Shock to the Drop and a range of different publications. He was decidedly underwhelmed by what was a kind of a scattershot Candyman, and he sort of took umbrage with that one, despite the fact that it's almost being universally lauded, which is something. And it makes me almost want to see it more, but I'm not entirely sure now about how I'm going to go about it. But obviously, when you treat criticism and movie criticism as gospel, it can only take you so far. So all that said, The Boy Behind the Door, I mean, comes with it just tons and tons, heaps and heaps of praise. And represents almost back-to-back films in which I've seen preteen protagonists, and it's a different kind of film to comprehend. This one is the work of two directors, and that's David Charbonnier and Justin Powell. I forget which one of them did The Djinn, and The Djinn is part of folklore from the Middle East, and it's something that really really resonates in places like Iran and Turkey and whatnot. But it's not a particular genre that really really captures me. And you could look at Wishmaster as the most mainstream introduction to North American audiences for this djinn, almost a genie type concept. But one of these directors here, either Charbonnier or Powell, was responsible for that one. And I was just thinking, like, I couldn't really come to terms with a two-headed monster directorial team, because, like, famously, like, Tobe Hooper and Steven Spielberg were, I mean, it really depends to what extent one was doing what and who was doing what in the finished product of Poltergeist. But at least with that one, you could say, let's say that Steven Spielberg wielded a very heavy influence because of his directorial clout at the time, and might have leaned on Tobe Hooper in considerable ways to be able to get the finished product out. But a two-headed two-headed directorial team is a little bit tough to fathom. I mean, the content creators for Really Awful Movies are obviously an author duo, Jeff and I, and even we had some issues trying to collaborate to get a cohesive, presentation of our two books, because you always have two slightly different styles, and I had to pivot somewhat to be less sort of a glibly one-liner humorous, and he in order to accommodate his desire to fill the book with more facts and details and production highlights. So I think the finished product actually turned out better by one of us ceding to the other. But I think depending on how you adhere to the auteur school of cinema, I'm not sure this really works when it comes to the directors, because you have this big production over which you manifest so much control. And I can't really think of, other than the examples I cite, I think I might have we might have covered a few twin directed films on the podcast, and none spring to mind, which is speaks volumes. But I just can't see how you could have in the auteur theory, I guess, limited as it is, when you have one person's vision really should come to the forefront, and you needn't look farther than our own city homeboy here, David Cronenberg, for the masterclass version of how the auteur plays out in a film. Like, that guy has meticulous control over many, many elements, and obviously for the better. Now, that's not to slight The Boy Behind the Door, because there's some incredible performances here, and I should go through the plot briefly. There's a couple of, speaking of the Yankees and baseball, but there's a couple kids, Kevin and Bobby, and they're ball players, baseball players, and they're throwing around the old ball middle of the summer, and one of them, I guess, throws it over the other one's head and goes down to the goes down into the ravine to fish it out. And just a warning here, I guess there's going to be spoilers galore in the upcoming comments here regarding this film, but one of them gets grabbed and KO'd and ends up in the trunk of the car, almost like the opening scene in Goodfellas or something. And it's a really jarring and really impactful opening. And Charbonnier and Powell have a really good, deft, and unflinching directorial touch to produce, I think, what is really, really an effective kidnapping thriller, if not an altogether straight-ahead horror, although there are horror elements that come to bear later on in the proceedings. But the beginning is just absolutely killer, and one of them is taken hostage when the other one is able to use his savvy and guile in order to wrest free of his confines and tries to rescue the other one. Everything takes place at this remote, very, very remote, sprawling home that is meant to be, I think, in one, either North or South Dakota. I can't recall which one had the oil boom, but there's an oil rig out front and it's going up and down. It's really beautiful surroundings and really austere and really creepy and creates a whole world unto itself, which, as we know and which, as we've discussed in the podcast previously, is one of the key elements to making a great piece of horror. And for the first 45 to hour of this film, I mean, you could, I think, safely say that it was. And this is very, very performance driven, as it has to be in a way. It is led by one of the characters who is Bobby Green, is played by Lonnie Chavis. And you'll know him from the somewhat maudlin, but I think overall quite sublime at times, TV drama This Is Us. And he really leads things. And there's these really juicy little tidbits and nuggets and little vignettes of interesting little means by which the kids try and escape, and really they acquit themselves really, really well as they try and elude their captors. And you have an element where Bobby tries to call for 911, and all he's got at his disposal is a rotary phone. And there's kind of a fun element where the kidnapped partner in crime there, well, not Kevin, has to sort of instruct him as to how to find an outlet and to plug it in so he can call first responders. That's a kind of cutesy moment. Also, there's a little grate, or a little, yeah, I guess you would call it that, that Kevin tries to open and splits open his fingernail, quite surprisingly, as he's trying to, elude capture. He's got some kind of thick lock that's around his ankle, and he's been, confined to the basement, and he tries to get out. It was really shocking and really well done, and yeah, it's amazing the extent to which something so easily relatable and yet not fatal could be so impactful and so stomach-churning. I mean, all it is a fingernail. It's not like some sort of Lucio Fulci, stake through the eye, like from The Beyond or something. I mean, Fulci is known for his ocular gouging and whatnot, but this is something that was really, really amazingly impactful and really disgusting and caused lots of squirming in that. So when you have, obviously the film has a lot of balls. Like, right from the get-go, you have a kid who's knocked unconscious. You know, unfortunately, things deteriorate toward the back of half of this film, which had its release date in 2020 at Fantastic Fest. But you have the back end not being able to cash the check that the first half had written. And that's really a shame. And why this is the case is that there are there's different characters and antagonists introduced in the proceedings that whose histrionics and hysteria kind of undermine what has come before. Now, when you are so bold as to be able to show a kid who's KO'd and knocked unconscious, you would think you'd go that extra mile to maybe generate that kind of terse, tense atmosphere that potentially this twosome could be it could be part of some pedophile ring or some kind of, that real harm could be inflicted on them. But from the get-go, and I think to this film's debit, the two kidnappers really just say, they try and placate the kids, and there's this element of that they're in it for the money rather than in it to really bring harm upon the kids. And I think that takes away from the proceedings here in order to probably to keep it on the straight and level and not to get an X or R rating. But I think it would have been really impactful, considering they were willing to go that route of knocking out a kid and having a very shocking scene. In the first 5 minutes, they could have at least, ratcheted up the terror, and maybe, like, I dare say it, ratchet up the torture porn elements that came to prominence in the 2000s, where you could have had a captor. And that would have also, this is a type of film that, I'm not fans of people being held captive in horror films. I find it very disturbing, unless it's used in a limited capacity, like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, when it's used for just evil, pure demonic thrills. But I think in this case, they could have used it to really make you further engage with the two heroes of this, because this is a different type of film. I mean, you know, your empathy and sympathy has been directed toward kids rather than the expected adults for whom you can sometimes not give two craps in the case of some of the later Friday the 13th movies, where they become almost interchangeable victims. But here, not only do you have a person of color, a young African-American kid, Bobby Green, but you have these, his buddy is almost kind of slight and a little bit wimpy and less resourceful, and you have this twosome in whom you have to, you know, invest your empathy and sympathy, and it turns this horror experience on its head, as does later introductions of the antagonist down the line, which becomes really, really surprising and, again, really shocking and really, really impactful and really daring and something you've never seen before. Now, toward the end, when the law enforcement eventually does show up, I mean, there's an element of predictability and lunkheaded, almost like as subtle as a ball peen hammer smashing a 2x4 or something. Like, it's just the elements of just over the top, just cheesiness that belies the preceding hour of repeated locked doors and creaky hallways and long dark vistas, and the horror capital that it is built up in almost in a Kubrickian way in The Shining. And I mentioned The Shining in that there's a direct callback to Jack Nicholson as Mr. Torrance, calling out, obviously, the Late Show with Johnny Carson. Here's Johnny as he busts through the door to attack Shelley Duvall with an axe. I mean, just even to reproduce that is an element of, pop culture, en courant pop culture, to the stuff that really took you out of the proceedings. Like, my wife frequently complains that if there's someone who's too A-list in a horror film, it almost takes you out of the proceedings, because as many of us came of age in the golden era of horror, and frequently the films would be populated with nobodies, obviously as a cost-saving measure. And when you have John Krasinski from The Office walking around, and whatever that movie is in, it's escaped me now, the one that's in complete silence there. Is it called The Quiet Ones? I don't know, but it can take you out of the proceedings. But I think anything that's like a obvious current reference, I think, can take away from something that something's timelessness and something's ability to be perceived as such. And that's why you get such long-lasting different generations, gravitating towards the likes of Suspiria, the Dario Argento Suspiria, and also The Shining, because you don't have anything that really traps it in a particular point in time. There's another element which I found a little off-putting, and so did the reviewers of Roger Ebert and his site, which was just a flash of a Make America Great Again bumper sticker that the killer had. And it's just like, it just sort of took you out of it in a way that seemed very, like, they later referenced this, the antagonist potential antipathy and racism toward kidnap victims. It just didn't ring true. Or if this was something that you could have inferred from the surroundings, that maybe one of these rural backwoods types would be someone like that. But it just seemed somehow like somewhat of a cheap shot, and somewhat out of place too, because there's not really any much of a correlation between voting habits, really, and propensity to commit crimes. I mean, Democrats are younger, and younger people commit crimes, but you'd have to be an idiot to infer causation from that correlation, because being a Democrat doesn't make you commit a crime. It's kind of a silly thing. I mean, then you have your Ted Bundy, who has campaigned for a Republican, so he's a Republican, who's a Democrat, all this silly ledger counting of who isn't and who is on the right side of history. It just doesn't seem like a seemed a little bit vaguely ridiculous and took me out of it, but it wasn't that so much as the female antagonist who later comes to bear on the proceedings, in whom nothing was invested, because if you're going to do this kind of thing and feature a very, very evil female antagonist, then you should probably do it at the beginning and set up what would typically be the type of relationship they would have. When you look at some of our local evildoers here up in Ontario, which would be the Ken and Barbie killer, Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka, in which this twosome, led by him, did all this evil doing. And that's typically how couples would operate. So when she sort of comes in here, full of histrionics and wielding an axe, and it just, that part of it just was rendered silly. And it's a shame, because the back end of this really, really, really fell apart. And it really left a lot to be desired. And there are silly circumstances in which the antagonist has her finger cut off and is still running around and not maybe feeling faint or being lightheaded or falling down or bleeding out or anything, just continuing on business as usual on this full adrenaline rush and running around like some unstoppable force, like John Carpenter's The Shape. It was just just absolute, almost comical lunacy. And again, there was repeated beats that happened prior in the preceding hour that were, almost frustrating, but you could feel the frustration of the characters, because you had these old-timey lock from the inside farmhouse doors, and they kept locking and locking, and the Bobby character couldn't get into different rooms. So it set up almost this kind of existential dread, in addition to the creaky corridors, and the house took on its own vibe as well, almost akin to Burnt Offerings that Oliver Reed star from the 80s, that type of film, or House, or yes, The Shining, where the house itself had a real personality too. And again, Bobby's frustration and him being almost but not quite able to escape, and law enforcement being ineffectual, all these terrific things. And then you get the silliness of the one kid being stopped in his tracks by a shock collar. Lots of running around and shooting and shocking and chasing and just degenerating into sheer almost vaudeville running around, like almost Benny Hill style, just a chase. And it just didn't work when you have an antagonist in whom nothing has been invested suddenly just appearing, and you having to build up a bunch of antipathy toward them, because you had already these two kidnappers who were terrifically depicted. I was anticipating one to be like a out of his gourd, frothing at the mouth, spittle spewing nut job that we've come to know and expect from these types of films, but their ordinariness. Hannah Arendt's famous banality of evil observation, but these characters were as banal as they come, and that's what really ratcheted up the terror. And then to have suddenly this witch-like figure chasing them around, it just didn't do it for me toward the end. And as I wrote up on the site, I would have to give this, the beginning was a 4.5-star film, and then the later half was a 2. So you could almost split the difference. And it's a film that could have gone really hard and could have stuck to its guns on the kidnapper front and could have really, really been something, something very impactful with a few minor tweaks. I was thinking actually of a survivalist horror that I recently podcasted that's also straddled the thriller horror divide, kind of, which was Alone, which I thought was just a really compelling, a cat and mouse chase between a kidnapper and a victim that taking place throughout the backwoods of Oregon and Washington State. And this creep who's tailing this woman along a deserted mountain underpass and following her to truck stops and eventually kidnapping her, and that they have very similar feels and very similar aesthetic, and they're both exceptionally done to a certain extent. But again, the boy behind the door, it just fell a little bit short, and it's just such a damn shame. And one of the movies that Jeff and I lament having to podcast, because with a few slight tweaks would have been absolutely fantastic, because you got atmosphere to spare. There's shots of actual beauty in this, and Jeff and I have alluded to the beauty of horror, but there's certain scenes where one of them that has this terrific shot under this tree branch of the kid playing baseball, and there's another one where the sun beams in through a window onto the kidnapped Kevin. And it's just scenes of cinematic beauty for this one. It just didn't ultimately come together in the way that I'd really, really hoped. Now, apparently the filmmakers really, and we're going to get into what we learned here, claim to have based elements of the film on The Shining and The Goonies. And it's kind of, yeah, I mean, it seems like any kid-centered movie or any kind of series, whether it's Stranger Things or whatever, invariably The Goonies comparisons are called out. I'm not sure to what extent that's true, but I mean, damn, it's just so many conventions are upended in this film, and then to have it just laid to waste in the back end with 35 minutes to spare just almost breaks my heart in a way. So many things I've learned here, but I am starting to really ratchet up the horror viewing now, because in this part of the world, and this is something I probably should have led the podcast with, but the seasons are starting to change. There's a little nip in the air, despite it being like, whatever, 25 degrees today or 80, whatever that is, Fahrenheit. Really, really hot day, but still, you can tell things are changing. And there's in Christian theology, there's something called quietism, which is like a, you know, turning inward into yourself, into your own citadel, as it were, and really finding time to contemplate. And a far less ecumenical version of that is how I treat the fall and horror films. I mean, the fall is really the ultimate time to get into horror, and I really, really am grateful for living in a place where the passage of time can be determined by the changing of the seasons, and horror is best experienced in you know, I used to think in front of a live audience, but I don't think as much. I just think when there's that crackle in the air and the leaves are changing, and it might have something to do with the iconic film Halloween, or maybe that is, this is a really secular, almost, you know, religious, quasi-religious holiday, but there's nothing that beats it. And if you live in a climate that doesn't change, like Southern California or one of these places, you really are missing out on some of the most amazing elements of horror, because really, I admit I've watched quite a bit of horror over this past summer, but I really dial things up to 11. Thanks, Nigel Tufnell from Spinal Tap, but I put things up to 11 in the fall and in the winter for the, which are the key disproportionately you know, in terms of viewing time, key horror seasons. I mean, TIFF is around the corner, Toronto International Film Festival, Midnight Madness, all the great stuff, and hopefully our pals there over at Rue Morgue will be able to put on some kind of Halloween production. I have my eye on a concert that's taking place, speaking of theology, over at one of the local churches here, and they're going to be doing, I think, a string quartet, versions of different horror themes. It's going to be pretty good, but there's lots of different things to see. There's a quirky local multimillionaire from 150 years ago or something who built this crazy mansion on top of a hill called Casa Loma, and last year that was transformed into a haunted house. And to great effect. It was really fantastic. So I'm looking forward to just going out and even on a much smaller scale, seeing what my neighbors have to offer, because there's tons of creativity in this part of the city where I'm at. And hopefully people will really get out and be inspired by the looming Halloween season. So yeah, I hope to talk to everyone soon. And the boy behind the door, I give it a reluctant thumb and a half up, speaking of severed digits. Metacritic, it's weighs in at 65 out of 100. It seems about fair, worth checking out. I'm hoping to catch Candyman at some point, but I'm really finding it tough on the just the logistics of it, but we'll see. That's something that I've had my eye on for quite a while, and frankly is something that appeals to me way more than the poorly titled and given the last installment, less, I guess, anticipation filled than I might have hoped, Halloween Kills. And they have a lot to answer for after that 2018 monstrosity, which is, just gets worse the more I think about it and talk about it. But looking forward to the horror season, looking forward to everyone listening and taking part. If you have any suggestions, send them our way. We're at awful_movies on Twitter. You can find us on Instagram and everywhere, really. And continue to check out our podcast, and we shall talk to you soon. Take care. Thank you.